I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my next interview is with filmmaker, historian, author, and journalist Ryan McKenna, who's best known for his provocative and prize-winning films on Canada and world history, Great War, The Killing Ground, War at Sea. And he's got a new film coming out, Newfoundland at Armageddon. It's going to be airing on CBC on June the 30th and then available online. We talk about a lot of things, as per usual, in most of my interviews. But one of the most fascinating things that we talk about is how Brian was sort of propelled into storytelling, and it's a great story, and you're going to need to listen to the interview to find out a little bit more about it. But it involves bullying, and it's a great story. But we talk about filmmaking, we talk about history and the madness of war, and this idea of a just war and unnecessary war, and we talk about personal stories and how they have or can have and do have an impact on not only who we are, but how we're going to behave in the future as well. And so, fascinating conversation with Brian. I hope if it doesn't introduce you to his filmmaking and his career, I hope it does definitely today. If you don't know him, you will now. Brian McKenna is with us here today, davidpecklive.com, for more info about my podcasting and speaking and so on. Brian McKenna and Newfoundland at Armageddon. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We are joined by a very special guest today. He's a filmmaker, historian, author, journalist. Brian McKenna here is with us today to talk about his new film, Newfoundland at Armageddon. It's going to air on CBC on June the 30th at 8 p.m. Brian, thanks for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation.
So your documentary background, The Great War, The Killing Ground, War at Sea, The Valor and the Horror, you seem to have a career.
Korea.
Yeah, built around stories about war. Is it a fascination? Is it a your own desire personally to sort of come to terms with it in its own way? Is that kind of what has drawn you to some of these stories, or can you talk about that a bit?
The story of the country is the story of war, from the days of the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, Wolf and Hong Kong facing each other, and with the French crown fighting the English crown, and the English crown vanquishing. It starts there, and then into the War of 1812, oh my God, I had no idea how close we came to being all American. just because of the valiance of Brock and Tecumseh especially, and I'd never heard of Tecumseh's role and critical role in the War of 1812, that without his intervention, there would be no Canada, really. And that led me to a series on chiefs, where the idea of using descendants began to really take shape. And the idea is, for example, on the chief series, was take the grandson of Sitting Bull and bring him to the Little Bighorn, where that incredible battle was fought, and let the story unfold, where he, in fact, tells his son the story of the battle.
So is there a sense in which we're not Canadians unless we sort of, you know, understand some of these stories, as far as you're concerned?
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
What makes it, of course, much more complex is the fact that the huge waves of immigration we've seen bring every one of these immigrants, many of them refugees, mm-hmm. bring their own stories mm-hmm. of war. And those stories are woven delicately into the fabric of our country. And that's the challenge that around the world, of course, this is being challenged, the idea of the refugees, of the immigrants, and their critical role in the future of the country. And we've just had in England the rejection of an incredible experiment, in this Brexit thing, and from there we move to another level with hopefully an American presidential election that will shake us all to the very roots. Everyone should be down on their hands and knees, praying.
Right. For praying for what? Maybe is the question.
Well, that's part of it, isn't it?
Yeah. What do we need? You know, what is around the corner? It does seem like a bit of a frightening time. I mean,
we live just around the corner from Bernie Sanders, so it's been amazing to see his campaign launched from nothing. I think he had 0.5% of the vote when he started off, and here he is challenging the Democratic establishment.
Bernie Sanders is a great guy to sort of invoke as we talk about, you know, your career as a filmmaker, your obviously your desire for social change of various kinds. You want to tell stories, and I would imagine shift the dialogue and the conversation to some degree. I had no idea about Newfoundland at Armageddon, or at least certainly knew about the Battle of the Somme and. And I have to tell you, I was not that long ago was in the U.S., driving through Washington, D.C., and I had the opportunity to make a crack about how, don't forget, we did beat you, a few years ago, not that long ago.
Not that long ago.
And so this, the guy who was sort of chauffeuring me, a friend, as it turns out, but he was sort of quick to make sure that I still knew who was in control. It was really kind of interesting.
Yeah, in fact, when we did the series, the PBS people who we tried to get involved in buying it said, well, that's not the war we learned in.
That's hilarious. Especially saying that to a documentarian is very funny.
Yeah.
So is there something in your past that brought you into the narrative of this story, Newfoundland at Armageddon and the Battle of the Somme and July the 1st? And I find it fascinating that for so many Canadians, this is a day of celebration, yet for some, still very much a day of remembrance. I think that's
Well, for my own family, my grandfather's kid brother fought the Battle of the Somme. He was killed, I guess, 2 months earlier than the battle that was fought by the Newfoundlanders. But he is laid to rest just outside the Belgian city of Ypres, where he was killed on the 26th of January.
Yeah, I have family there as well.
Yeah, well, there. I mean,
Courcelette.
Canadians. I mean, they have no idea that. I think it's 400,000 killed and wounded.
About 58,000 soldiers died on the Allies' side the first day.
Yeah, that's right.
The first day.
By noon.
By noon.
60,000 were gone.
The narrator in your film, when he sort of unpacks, as you reenact the scene and the machine guns and so on, within a half an hour, I believe, most of the Newfoundlanders had been gunned
down. 22 minutes.
Oh, all it's just, I'm getting a shiver as we chat about
The
it.
Sons, the fathers, the women watching them go, knowing they're not going to come back. And the men in the trenches hours before were not very far from those minutes where that extraordinary battalion gathered themselves up, heard the whistle blow, and rose up out of the mud, and the blood and began the march, the desperate, terrible march into the German machine guns. And the German machine gunners were terrified. They were outnumbered 7-1.
Oh, is that right?
And they see these, and they said if the Newfoundlanders had only run,
right,
they could have overrun us.
Well, I can't even begin to describe the horror I felt for, you know, I've certainly watched a few films over the years. I've read a few books. Adam Hochschild, by the way, one of my favorite authors.
Yeah, he's
true. He's utterly brilliant. You know, and I've heard the history and I've read it and so on. But to see it reenacted in such a compelling way in your film was heartbreaking, gut-wrenching to walking speed. Let me get this straight. You're going to go up a ladder. You're going to carry a ladder,
yeah,
across an open field at walking speed while machine gun fire is coming at you, and you're going to do nothing other than get mowed down.
Yeah,
to define that as absurd is an understatement at best. It seems to me.
Under the pain that it implies from every level, and also a society that sends its best.
Right.
To war.
Mm.
Its best lawyers, its best engineers, its best fishermen by the hundreds. You send them off to battle. You just know that most of them are not going to come back.
Right.
I mean, you're hoping against hope, but, you know, the word starts to filter back that something terrible happened on the 1st of July, and we're not going to talk about it very much. And, in fact, the real war didn't come back for about 2 weeks after the battle. But for us, it was catching those moments. You know,
yes, the
Air family.
Yes.
And four of them killed within an hour of each other.
Four of them
and
died.
And the patriarch, he still can't talk about it without his eyes moistening.
Mm.
And just, you know, he says, I know within a few feet where each one of them died, each one of the four. And it's just... we're 100 years later, and it's still like it happened yesterday.
It happened yesterday.
And, of course, it's that magnificent recreation of a battlefield that the Newfoundlanders have done, that the women of Newfoundland gathered with the chaplain of the regiment who lost his faith in God that morning and basically decided that they were going to preserve this battlefield. And it is the most moving battlefield on the Western Front, with the possible exception of Vimy Ridge, but Vimy Ridge is more a declaration of nationhood, while I guess the Newfoundlanders was a loss of nationhood, and that is at the core of, we had some discussion about that. The Newfoundlanders believed that they lost their country that morning.
Right.
They lost.
Well, in a sense,
dominion.
They did.
They were a dominion just like Canada, and it was gone.
Oldest colony of the British Empire, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, 1940. So was there a sense in which Britain disregarded Newfoundland? I mean, they called it,
the cod fishery.
The grand cod fishery of the universe.
Yeah.
Which is lovely, depending, I guess, for dinner conversation.
Well, it's patronizing as hell.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, the Brits basically, they insisted the Newfoundlanders pay their own shot, and then after the war, when everyone else had their sins forgiven and their debts forgiven, then the Newfoundlanders were told, no, that's not going to happen for you. And so they basically scraped together over how many generations every last penny and paid off their full war debt. And in doing so, basically finished off any possibility of them having a separate
country. Did I hear that right? $100 million in debt in 1932?
Yeah, no, it's beyond, there are a quarter million people. What's going on here?
Yeah, no, this is insane. Couldn't even service the interest at that point.
No. And the women, of course, this is a story that I've been trying to get at for how many of these series, and I kept saying that, you know, I'm going to include the story of the women much more powerfully.
Mm.
Sometimes when you have to make a cut, that story goes,
and that story goes.
But we were determined it wasn't going to happen this time.
Right.
They're going to be front and center. And that became an important part of the film. The idea that they raised $20 million by selling potatoes.
Right.
By auctioning off.
It's a lot of potatoes.
Sweaters and
just
amazing what those women did. And the grief that they carried around on a daily basis. I just can't imagine.
Well, It's interesting to me how you kind of, I mean, it's certainly a continuous thread throughout, and I don't know how you can't think about the splash and ripple effect and the implications of the things that we do today affect what we do tomorrow and so on. But the impact of this, as you say, 100 years later, right? And just the generational impact, and so and how it had an effect, and the PTSD and the grief that these people carried. What kind of people are we today that we wouldn't have been, you know, if we didn't have this?
Newfoundlanders. Yeah. I mean, even the fact that their university is called Memorial, and it's called Memorial because it's remember that terrible morning.
Right.
And that's why it's called Memorial, indeed.
I mean, what do you learn, you know, as a historian, as an author and journalist and filmmaker that clearly has had a theme? What do you learn about human nature? What do you learn about the madness that is civilization from making these films about war? Is it always going to be a part of who we are and our future? Or
I think it is always. Mm. It is part of the DNA the species, I guess. And it's a question of channeling it and controlling it. And stopping it, and I mean, right through. I mean, Pierre Trudeau, whose memoirs I had the great good fortune to make, was a real understood war, and decided that he wasn't going to get involved very deeply, especially in the Second World War, and he took a lot of heat for that. But that was a constant theme, never advertised loudly, but a constant theme in his writing and his work. And it was opposition to war. And of course, in the 1960s, I ran into. Well, I was a university student editor. Mm. So where the hell was I going to? I was on the street. I was not almost on the streets. I was on the campus waving placards and taking on Jesuit priests who were quite determined to shut me down in my valiant attempts at being a newspaper editor. But no, it's a constant theme.
I think I forget who it was, but somebody in the film talks about the machinery being in motion, and once some of those decisions were made on that morning to
well, we haven't even touched on this madman.
The madman of it, the
Haig.
Haig, exactly. And what's interesting, I did a little bit of research on my wife's great Elizabeth's great grandfather, who died at Courcelette in France a few months after this
battle.
No, the
Canadian, the Van Duz fought at Courcelette.
Well, Haig was leading that group as well. You know, and so you watch this in some kind of context here, and you say, how is this even possible? You know, which you've also got people in the film asking that question as well.
Yeah, and well, and eloquently asked in terms of the way it unfolded. Mm. I mean, the question was asked by Gwyn Dyer and no better Newfoundlander, you know, and Adam Hochschild basically saying this man was a megalomaniac. He was touched by God to bring glory and honor to the British race, and there was no need to worry about the battle. His men, you know, they were ordered to do something and do it. And I'm sure we'll do it well. And meanwhile, let's sit down and have some champagne the night before.
Well, it's insanity. When you cross cut that scene with the champagne scene, it's just insane. I think Hochschild said in the film, paraphrase, your Peckian paraphrase, but God, when God is enlisted, anything you do is justifiable.
That's right.
And it seems to kind of change everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's a haunting story too. I mean, even almost literally in terms of, I'd never heard of the word fetch before, but the idea that this ghostly presence, her son, one afternoon on the 1st of July, 1916, appears in the tree line.
Right.
And she realizes that he's probably dying this moment, and fetch is the Newfoundland word for a ghost, a ghost that is sent to summon,
right,
or to reveal. In this case, the revelation was her son was gone, and the way that she tells it, there's no question in your mind that this is what happened. And actually, in the film I made on the Battle of Hong Kong in the Second World War, another soldier told a similar story about it. He basically was almost in conversation with his mother and assuring her that he was going to be okay, and he actually ended up okay. The ghost declared himself.
Mm. Are you, just in, as we sort of tease out some of the stuff around Hague and so on, would you call yourself a pacifist?
Mm.
It's a big question.
No, I'm not a pacifist. The battles had to be fought. When I, we started this conversation talking about war, mm. and for me, these are the wars that laid the basis for the country, and, mm-hmm. and it starts with the Battle of the Plains of Abraham. It continues into the War of 1812. I mean, you come to Montreal, you walk down the Chateau de Ramsey in the old city. You should understand that in the winter of 1813, that winter Benjamin Franklin was there with the occupying American army.
Mm.
They had actually taken the city. And then they were driven out. And without that battle being fought, we wouldn't have a Canada.
Right.
And so I can't declare myself a pacifist because I support the war. I mean, St. Augustine talked about the just war, and I believe, in fact, there are just wars. To escape the tentacles of the American Empire, we fought a bloody war, and we prevailed. And... thank God for that.
Mm. Yeah, it's so funny, just the phrase "thank God for that," right? I mean, the invocation of a divinity at given points in our history has sort of, I suppose, in some ways, propelled us forward into the mm-hmm. future. But more often than not, it seems we hear about the stories where we go way sideways, where something doesn't unfold, it completely, like this battle, unravels as a result of this hubris and ego. And it has nothing to do with God, it seems to me. It has nothing to do with religion at all. This is,
well, especially
this is...
with the Germans invoking the same God, of course.
Right, right.
Because, in the end, I mean, we didn't really explore that fully, but the German generals were just as insane as the British generals when we got right down to it.
Mm.
But I guess on one side we say that the cause was greater. John Keegan, who is one of the great historians, not just military historians, he called this the Battle of the Somme River the greatest catastrophe in the history of Britain.
Wow.
And coming from him, that's really something. And and you see it, the scale of the slaughter and the way it unfolds, it's unspeakable.
It really is, and I think there was a line in the film that the narrator uses, how quickly it turned into chaos.
Mm.
And I don't think anyone any of us who haven't actually experienced that, the madness of barbed wire and the machine gun and the sounds. And I remember Elizabeth and I were in Vietnam, and we were wandering through a battlefield in Cu Chi, in a couple hours from Saigon, and there was a gun range. And we were walking by a tank that had been taken out by a delay mine. And it wasn't that overgrown from a jungle perspective and so on. But it was, we were sort of in the middle of it, wandering through a battlefield. And a machine gun went off in the background. And it was somebody at a shooting range, paying a buck a bullet or something ridiculous. And I remember saying to Elizabeth, can you imagine, landing here in darkness, things blowing up around you? You have, How do you humanize that, and communicate that through film or through story in a meaningful way? I mean, that I guess is the challenge, I suppose, of the filmmaker.
Well, I think that's why that I've used this technique now. And
that's the reenactment, is that?
Well, bringing the descendants in. It's not very far back. In some cases it's the father, in some cases it's the grandfather, and sometimes it's the great-grandfather, but it's the family mm-hmm. connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's nice.
And when they get
it's good.
And it's really something. Even
it is. Itself, it is.
When I went first to the small cemetery outside the city of Ypres, where Adrian McKenna is buried, and when I first saw his name on that white stone, carved, Corporal Adrian McKenna, died January 26, 1916, and it just sends a shiver down your back.
Mm-hmm.
And what sends the shiver is the maple leaf that's carved beside
right.
his name. And that is what really gets you. These war cemeteries are just really something all the way through the Western Front.
Did you see, you know, these family members telling these stories, reenacting them. I mean, quite compelling, the footage of them getting prepared and dressed and not being able to put on some of the, you know, the backpack or the costume.
Well, in the same way their grandfather's, yeah. grandfather's
been figuring it out either. I mean, these were teenagers, right? Yeah. They were fumbling around. One 15-year-old, I think, as you point out in the film. What did anything, I mean, there must have been a really interesting sense of community that you developed on the film.
Oh, yeah, no, it's...
And revelations there, I would think.
Well, it's, yeah, on many different levels. But just on the smallest levels, then, I mean, the whole community got involved in helping us, you know, even making a battlefield,
right.
Digging the trenches. And we weren't, at one point, we weren't happy with the way that the battlefield was too green. and we basically got some blowtorches and stuff, but that didn't do much. And the hotel where we were staying, the whole crew, the owner of the hotel heard we were having these problems, and he went and rounded up half a dozen guys and with blowtorches and the rest of it and turned a green battlefield into a black morass.
That's pretty funny.
I can't imagine that happening anywhere else in Canada.
Right.
You know, just the Newfoundlanders deciding that they're going
to
tell this story. We couldn't have told it as well as we hopefully did without those kinds of aids.
There's near the end of the film, I think one of the not sure who it was, but the quote was, "People suffer losses that change their lives forever." And I think the woman reenacting one of the mothers says, "You know, that bullet killed my husband just as it did our sons in France."
Right.
Because I think he died. That wasn't the heirs, was it? I think he died 3 years later
No, it was not one of the heirs.
Yeah, getting the news, husband. Their father was dead, never really came to terms with it. That sense of, you know, the splash and ripple effect, the implications of this will, the PTSD, the mental health implications will go on for years and years to come.
Oh, generation after generation. And there's no question about it.
So do we actually, you know, you sound a little, a little bit of a realist, you know, oh yeah, you know, it's in our DNA, maybe desire to fight, is that it? Or maybe it's a sense of pride, nationalism. I'm not 100% sure what it is, but what do we learn? I mean, you know, are you hopeful?
I think I asked Wayne Dyer the same thing.
Mm.
He looked me square in the eye and said, "War is a terrible thing."
Mm.
And you can write, as you know, there's an encyclopedia has been written about war. And we try and tell important stories for this country in a distinctive way and honor the men who died putting the country together. And that's all we can do in the end, and hope that it has an impact on the next generation, that they will not fight unnecessary wars. Is that too much to hope? Depending, I guess, who is in power at any given time.
Well, the affliction of war is a great phrase that comes up at the end of the film.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the word affliction is just, I don't know, works on a few levels for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, the post-traumatic stress syndrome it almost runs through the entire film.
Right.
The echo of the horror just down the tunnel of the ears and the impact it has on these young men to see four generations later. There it is, war in all its unspeakable glory and horror.
So, Brian, we got to wrap it up probably in a few minutes, but I'd love to hear a little bit. And by the way, congratulations! And just as a quick reminder here, so it's airing this Thursday, June 30th at 8 p.m. on CBC. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
So, congratulations on the film again. Tell me a little bit. Why did you choose the whole, you know, storytelling? I mean, would you have always been that? Were you always that as a kid? And did you sort of, did film choose you, or did you choose it as a kind of a career, would you say?
I was bullied a lot.
okay.
school, and
that explains everything, Brian.
And so what happened was one day I was taxed by a couple of bullies on the way home from school, and they took all my change from, I had just finished collecting from the Gazette route, my newspaper route. And so I had a couple of bucks that I was saving to have a chocolate ice cream soda at McDonald's Pharmacy
right.
in Balboa, Quebec, and they took my money, and so I went home and I didn't know. I was at a loss. The idea of telling my parents was just didn't seem right somehow. So what happened was I sat down and wrote an account of the taxing and the theft.
How old were you at this point?
I guess 9.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
So I wrote it up.
Yeah.
I came in early and I put it on the teacher's desk, and I just watched to see what would happen. And it was like I'd rolled a hand grenade down the center aisle, and the two bullies were summoned from their desks.
Wow.
And one of them was expelled for life, basically, and the other was, I guess, suspended for the rest of the year. So I, in those brief minutes, I learned the power of words.
Wow. Yeah.
And ever since then, I've respected the power of words enormously, and they are the ones that that have taken me this far in using the English language. And as that lovely phrase, John Kennedy's phrase about Churchill, that he marshaled the English language and sent it off to war.
Mm.
Well, I guess our films are constantly trying to do that.
Do you think the film, the reenactment, the documentary is a better way, a more, effective way to tell a story than, say, a piece of poetry or a play or a novel, for say?
Well, I think we try and weave, especially with Newfoundlanders, we try and weave the poetry of the place.
Right.
The power of the poetry of the place, if I may.
Right, nice. Yep.
Into the story, and that... In storytelling on film, you have two choices. You can do what we call exposition. You know, take a look at all these facts, interesting facts, and drama, the dramatic telling of the story, that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to the story. And sometimes we're successful in doing it, sometimes not so. But it's all in the storytelling in the end. And I've just been so lucky. I've had so many shots at trying to get it right. And I'll, as you may be aware, in trying to get it right in the First World War, we took on the Bomber Command veterans, and they sued us for $500 million, a lawsuit that went all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court, a lawsuit that we fought, and which stole a year from my life. So these are not just academic issues.
Mm-hmm.
For,
mm-hmm.
They go right to the fundamentals of freedom of speech, and...
Well, and to kind of come full circle to our interview, they kind of define us, well, they have to define us as Canadians.
Yes.
And define us a bit differently, I guess, if we don't know the story, obviously. But I guess that's part of your project as a filmmaker, as a poet, as an author, and so on, to offset, to footnote people's Canadian history here and there. Is that a fair way to say it?
Well, it's... more than footnotes. We try and footnote our stories, but
right.
The thrust of the story is just gathers the momentum as you find.
Yeah, out. I guess what I meant is footnote, like a footnote to my life. Like I am now, at the risk of overstating, I'm a different person as a result of this story, of this mm-hmm. conversation, and so on. And will I, honestly, it's already 3 phone calls and a couple emails
right.
out to others, out to my mother-in-law. Well, tell me about granddad, tell me about my granddad, and so on. And mm-hmm. so. Isn't that remarkable, really?
Well, actually, what the Canadian government is doing is really laudatory, because they basically put the story that each one of those Canadians, those 58,000 or almost 59,000 Canadians who died in combat in the First World War, they put them online.
Mm.
And you can, it's a virtual
amazing.
War memorial.
Yeah.
You pop in the name and outcome. And in many cases, there's everything there, the whole the medical records, the... one of my grandfather's older brother won the Military Cross at the crossing of the an important canal, the Canal du Nord in northern France, and he was awarded the Military Cross by the King of England, and all a very big deal in those days. And that's all part of it, the telling of the story.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable. Just before we wrap up, I want to. There's a moment in the film where I think one of the narrators says something to the effect of the Newfoundlanders learned very quickly that quote rules were made to be followed.
Yeah, it's a lovely phrase.
It's a great phrase, but really, I mean, I've got philosophy in my background, et cetera, and I've always been more interested in the question. And so I don't know that I would have made a good soldier. I think I would have pushed back most of the time. Would you sort of define yourself? Do you have to be that kind of guy, somebody who pushes back, who asks questions?
Well, because I was pushed.
Right.
I pushed back, yeah.
So we can blame the bullies, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful, Brian. I'll look forward to going a little deeper with you sometime.
Oh, by the way, that phrase about the whole idea of the bullies and,
yes.
And rules that are meant to be broken.
Yeah.
That's Michael Crummy's very fine writing, and I salute his wonderful addition to our script.
Well, it's a wonderful film, and I hope everyone sees it. Newfoundland at Armageddon. It's going to air on CBC on Thursday, June the 30th at 8 p.m. I'm sure it's going to be, I would think, available online after that, or maybe there's a kind
no,
of...
No, it will be.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. And, Brian, thanks a lot for your time today. Brian McKenna, filmmaker, historian, author, and journalist.
Thanks for the great conversation.
Yeah, really, really appreciate your time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.